Ladies and gentlemen, independent presidential candidate, Mr. Ralph Nader.
Thank you very much, Dave. He's going to be a leader, that's for sure, if he isn't already. How many of you students here? How many are determined to be leaders in the advancement of justice as you see it after you finish your formal education? Huh? Well, let me put the hands up. Okay. Yeah, see, it's a small percentage. It's because you don't think about it. His class doesn't discuss this. Heaven forbid that you would be a leader. All kinds of leaders, not just political leaders. There are leaders in the graphic arts, civic movements, leaders, economic leaders, sustainable development, solar energy, educational leaders, getting civic skill courses in our schools so that the students connect with the community in the classroom under their teacher supervision and understand politics, geography, economics, healthcare, as they study their own community, the history of their community. So a lot of leaders. So I've redefined it. How many of you want to be leaders? Okay. Okay. I always try to understand when we gather like this what the experience of people has been. So I want to just a couple quick questions. How many of you have never been at a shopping mall? How many of you have never been at a McDonald's? I got to sign you up. A vegetarian? No? You're from Finland? How many of you have never been to a Walmart? Oh, are there Walmarts here? Yeah, okay. Now, okay, scene changes. How many have never been to a city council meeting? How many have never been in a court of law as a spectator? See what I mean? In other words, you're in the commercial arena, you want to buy things. In the civic arena, that helps shape the kind of country you're going to spend your lives in, that determines whether you're going to run this country or big business is going to run this country. Very little experience. Well, I had a lucky choice of parents. They took me to town meetings, Winston, Connecticut. They took me to the county courthouse down the street from my father's restaurant, which was opposite a couple of big textile factories by the Mad River. And they always took us to these public gatherings, and because they taught us how to listen, that was the first thing they did. They taught us how to listen. We weren't fidgety. We were observers. We soaked it in. We watched the adults go at it. And I always thought that was one big reason why I decided to that my American dream was pursuing justice for all the people, not pursuing wealth for just a few. So it's not too late. You can go to courtrooms. You can go to historical societies in your town. You could go to city council meetings. You can participate in referendums. And it would be nice if your teachers gave you credit for it. And that's what a civic skill course would be like. You'd learn how to practice democracy, how to challenge power, learn how to use the courts, small claims courts, don't need lawyers. You'd learn how to build coalitions, how to put on news conferences. You'd learn how to engage in conflicts under orderly procedures where you don't get discouraged if you lose, you bounce back. You don't get demoralized. Your best teacher is your last defeat, and you learn from it. And instead, who's got you in their clutches? Teenagers, students, corporations. You spend far more time with corporations than you do with your own family, with few exceptions. You're looking at screens, TV, internet, video, iPods, music. I don't know why you spend all that time listening to music. When we were your age, we listened to music. I mean, we didn't feel deprived, you know. It was Elvis, Frank Sinatra. You listen to music 6 times more than we do. And I don't think you've discovered a 36-hour day, have you? Still the same day. You've been commercialized, and you think you're really independent, because after all, you can pick your music, and you can pick your junk food, junk drink. You're a free human being. You're kidding yourself. You're being controlled. They control you by getting in your mind at age 3 and 4 with all these ads, age 5, 6, and they control you by getting in your bodies, the addictive industries. I didn't mean to come here and just talk to teenagers, but with your indulgence, your parents, I think it's very important not to pander and talk down to teenagers. I think that the hip-hop movement in 2000 and 2004 wanted to engage young people. And so I had a meeting with, I met with Russell Simmons on the phone and so on. I said, that's not the way to do it. He says, that's the way you get them, through hip-hop. No. You don't get them through hip-hop. You say to them, there's a time for fun as a time for serious pursuits. And this is your country, and you're going to be 17, 18,000 days before you turn 65, 2,200 weeks. It's going to go fast, and you want to make the best of it, and you want to make a mark on it. And so there's a time for fun, there's a time for serious, and hip-hop doesn't quite mix. And what happened? All these young people were brought to all these rallies, 18 and above, 2/3 of them didn't turn out to vote. So you want to really try to turn out to vote and put it on your little email list and get others to vote. And if you're as smart as a voter as you are a sports fan, you're going to make a very wise vote, because you're going to do your homework, you're going to study the records of the candidates. You're not going to knee-jerk Republican, knee-jerk Democrat, because your grandparents were Republican and Democrats. You're going to focus on performance, which is what sport fans do. They don't focus on rhetoric. If somebody's got a great smile on the diamond and has a great wave to the crowd and autographs until his hand drops off and he's batting 196, what matters? It's 196. That's not true with politicians. They love to flatter the voters so they can fool them and flummox them. And so voters turn out and support people who go to Washington and vote against their interests on behalf of their corporate paymasters. Again and again and again, they vote for the very people who give tax havens to corporations and rich people, put the burden on the rest of the people, who don't shut down damaging incinerators, who use your tax dollars to prop up and guarantee nuclear power plants, who don't protect you when your credit card company rips you apart in 20 different ways, who don't ever even have a public hearing to see what you want to propose to bring down gasoline home heating prices, who spend more time indexing their own salaries in Congress to inflation and forget about indexing the minimum wage, which would be $10 an hour now if it was indexed from 1968. I know Connecticut's a little higher. The federal minimum wage is $6.55. Who spend their time knuckling under to the criminal recidivist in the White House, King George IV, who's plunged us into a criminal war from which there seems to be no end, with horrible casualties on the Iraqi side and a lot of pretty bad casualties on our side, and $14 million an hour of your money is spent 24 hours a day on that war in Iraq. Not $14 million an hour strengthening bridges, remodeling schools here, establishing clinics, renovating libraries, upgrading drinking water systems, sewage treatment systems, public transit, which Connecticut needs very badly, modern public transit. Oh no, it's $14 million to blow apart that country that never threatened us. And now we want to expand it in Afghanistan. And Obama and McCain are the same. You look at our website, votenader.org, you'll see a 2.5 minute video where you'll see how their very words on issue after issue are exactly the same. On aggressive posture to Iran, on support of the Israeli military repression and occupation and colonization of Palestine, on Russia and Georgia, on more soldiers in Afghanistan, on expanding the military budget. It's like Siamese twins, ditto heads. And then they really go after each other, don't they, to make you think that they're all that different. Well, there is some difference. Obama has raised more money from corporate interest groups and corporate lawyers than John McCain by a large margin. So that's one difference. There's a difference. I wonder why Wall Street is investing in Barack Obama so much. McCain doesn't talk about a living wage. Obama does. Here's what a living wage is for the great community organizer from Chicago. $9.50 by 2011. In other words, by 2011, he wants a living wage, he says, that is less in purchasing power for groceries and rent and so on than it was in 1968. Even though since 1968, productivity per worker, the worker is twice as productive, you know, automation, machines, and so on, than that worker was in 1968. Now, this might appear to be news. Well, how about the drug war? Well, they're both for the drug war. What about the embargo toward Cuba? Well, Obama was against it, and he switched when he went to South Cuba and said, South Florida, and said, we'll continue the embargo. That's exactly what Castro wants. He's loved the embargo because that's how he consolidates control, by showing that the U.S. is trying to squeeze this little island in the Caribbean. And it just goes on and on. The drug war is an example. The drug war is a monstrosity. We do not send nicotine addicts to jail. We don't send alcoholics to jail. Why do we send people with drug addiction to jail? Possession of marijuana, possession of heroin. We're not talking about the big drug dealers. We have hundreds of thousands of nonviolent drug offenders in jail. And it's costing you between $40,000 and $50,000 per inmate. So I have... And Matt Gonzalez, a civil rights lawyer in San Francisco, and was head of the San Francisco City Council, elected when he was in his 30s. We believe that there should be an amnesty for all nonviolent drug offenders, emptying the cells. At the same time, we expand the prosecution and conviction of these corporate crooks and put them in the emptied cells. And these crooks are not just Wall Street swindlers. They're the ones who allow dangerous conditions in the workplace. 58,000 Americans die, according to OSHA, from work-related diseases and trauma. That's every 3 weeks there's a 9/11 equivalent of deaths that are preventable. These are the people who don't monitor the hospitals sufficiently. And a lot of medical negligence, unfortunately, takes about 100,000 lives a year, preventable, according to the Harvard School of Public Health. These are the people who continue to deny that coal is a crime against humanity, and someday we will never allow it to be mined, strip-mined, stream-silted, blown off mountains in West Virginia for the coal, and affect climate change. 30,000 Americans die because of pollution from coal-burning plants, EPA figures. These are the people who deceive you and gouge you as consumers? Who hasn't been gouged? How many people here have ever had a bounce check? Okay. You're charged at least $30. You know what it really costs the bank, according to the Federal Reserve? $2, including check fraud. They charge you $28 profit, and you can't do anything about it because they've got your money, and they just debit you. If they required you to write a $30 check, there'd be a real tumult out there, right? They just debit you. And that's what the credit card industry does, and the debit card industry. They just debit you. You don't have a chance to argue. You don't have a chance to say, hey, whoa, let's talk this over. Maybe you made a mistake. Instantaneous. Debit, debit, debit. The banks charge you for everything but breathing. Oh, there's one other thing. The depreciation as you walk across their rugs, you know, when you wear their rugs. They don't quite charge you. You don't have any say in this. And there was a credit card company a few years ago we were investigating, Advanta. They were charging their customers $25 if their customer quit the company. $25. You quit? $25. You see? And 30, 50, 60 years ago, people either had to pay cash or they had to pay check. And that's different. They can't get away with it like that. And now, if you complain and you're in this credit card business industry, you know, you're part of the credit card world, if you complain, they will say to you, let's say you complain because you got a lemon car and you complain to the auto dealer. And you complain, and the auto dealer doesn't respond to your concerns. You've got a clunker. And finally, the salesperson will say, in a polite way, you know, if you continue to complain, your credit score is going to go down, and your credit rating will be adversely affected. See how they shut you down? Who needs a dictator? Dictators are crude. You got to smash your door down at 4 a.m. These guys do it with a pen. They do it with a computer, just like that. We're talking billions and billions and billions of dollars. There are $220 billion fleeced out of our healthcare expenditures due to computerized billing, fraud, and abuse. I never heard Obama or McCain ever mention that. That comes from the General Accounting Office of the U.S. Congress, a very respected group of accountants and auditors. And they say that 10% of the entire healthcare expenses that we have to endure are drained away by all these complex billing, the codes that you can't understand when you get these printouts, right? And I called up the leading expert on this at Harvard, Malcolm Sparrow. I said, what do you think of this figure, 10%? He said, that's the most conservative figure. Could be double that. There are actually consulting firms who show how to design bills for hospitals, doctor practices. All these are just a few examples of the controlling processes, how we lose our freedom, we lose our liberty, and we have to endure these injustices. So it's important, when you're talking about a presidential campaign, is say, look at Ralph Nader. He's been on here around fighting for you for 40, 45 years. I went down to Washington. I lost a lot of my friends in Connecticut, high school, and then later in New Jersey at college in crashes. And I began looking into it. And I got pretty upset because a lot of these crashes were survivable. But there were no seatbelts. There was no airbags. There was no laminated glass, shatterproof glass. There was no collapsible steering column. The steering column collapsed you rather than you hitting the steering column and sort of telescoping the steering column. The door latches were so weak, especially on the Volkswagen. I told the Volkswagen company that they should advertise that their car comes with an invisible valet, because you drive your little Volkswagen Beetle up to your home, and if you're rather tired after a long day, you just turn the wheel, hit the curb, and the doors pop open. So I went to Washington, actually hitchhiked, because I like to hitchhike. That's how truckers pick me up. We'd see a lot of crashes before the police ever came, and watch traffic maneuvers. And I went to the Congress, and I basically said, something's got to be done about it. And there were some good members of Congress there who listened. Senator Rebikoff from Connecticut, Senator Magnuson from Washington State. They had committee chairs of some significance. They were chairs of committees. And we got through the motor vehicle and highway safety laws in 1966. Lyndon Johnson signed them into law. And irregularly enforced. Irregularly enforced, they've saved over a million lives and tens of millions of injuries prevented or reduced in severity. And they upgraded some imports, because a lot of imports were coming in and they couldn't meet our standards. They couldn't be sold here. Now, we went on to gas pipeline safety law, product safety commission law, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, EPA, establishing EPA, establishing the occupational safety law. I said to myself, wow, this is the American dream. Justice, the great work of human beings on earth, Senator Webster once said. Justice. And it went on, and the corporations started their counterattack. They started buying both Democrats and Republicans, where they used to put more money into the Republican Party. They beefed up their lobbying. They would threaten to go to Mexico or some other country that didn't have these standards. They began running their own candidates. They expanded their putting high executives in government positions. And slowly the door began to close. And here we have all our citizen groups that we've started and other citizen groups we worked with and labor unions and religious groups for working for social justice. And it was all closing down on them. And it started heavily in 79 and 2000 and then got worse. 79 and 1980. And then Reagan came on, the cruel man with a smile, and then George Bush came on, and then Clinton came on, and things just kept worse. We couldn't get petitions responded on serious drug hazards and food contamination and air pollution and fuel efficiency and auto safety. Just began all closing down. And all these groups that you send your dues to, you know, Sierra Club, ACLU, NAACP, and, you know, prison reform groups and labor justice groups, they couldn't get anything done. They didn't want to admit it. It's hard to admit it because you got to keep the supporters around the country happy, thinking that you're trying to do the best thing, and you are, but the doors are slamming. And so what we saw is the emergence of one giant corporate party with two heads, Republican, Democrat, wearing different makeup. The Democrats were a lot different than Republicans years ago. They're a little different now. They're better on Social Security. They're better on gay, lesbian rights. They're better on some civil rights. But not as much as one would have thought, given their history. And now we see in Washington the bailout. Now, this is the ultimate proof that both parties are irrevocably corrupt and indentured to the worst swindlers and confiscatories of other people's money that they held in trust, worker pension money, mutual fund money. And they drained trillions of dollars and enriched themselves at the top of these companies, brokerage firms, banks, investment banks. And when their company started tanking, they jumped ship into a golden lifeboat with huge severance pay, after hundreds of thousands of workers were laid off. And of course, investors lost very, very great percent of their hard-earned savings. And so they all go to Washington. These crumbling giants in Wall Street, the bastions of capitalism, go to Washington and ask socialism to bail them out, which is why they always get away with what they're doing, because they know that they're too big in our economy to be allowed to fail, and therefore they go to Uncle Sam, and voila, in a few days, they put on your back and the back of your children $700 billion. Now, when I went to Washington, if they did $1.5 billion loan guarantee to Chrysler, they had days of congressional hearings. And they went it all over with a fine-tooth comb. And witnesses from around the country, academics and lawyers and economists. This $700 billion bailout was passed without any public hearings. All they had was senators and representatives at hearings questioning the Secretary of the Treasury and the Chairman of the Federal Reserve. So you have all these people who, I think, knew that this was, A, the wrong bailout, and a very incomplete bill. They were not allowed to testify. Some of them were in Wall Street. Some of them were around the country. They weren't allowed to testify. We weren't allowed to testify. The American people were shut down by Barney Frank and Chris Dodd and Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid and their Republican counterparts. And the people are outraged around the country, angered around the country. Regardless of Democrat, Republican, this is so raw an injustice that your tax dollars are bailing out crooks, swindlers, and speculators who enriched themselves, who had the inside information to jump ship, tanking their companies, and taking away all these investments and destabilizing the economy. And then they send you the bill, and they say to you, shut up and take it. And I don't think we should be told, shut up and take it. And we got a month. We got a month before the election. They're all coming back, all 535 of them. Two-thirds of them voted for this bailout. All 535 of them put their shoes on every morning like you and I do. 1,500 corporations, none of which have a single vote, get their way with a majority of those 535. And we're the ones who have the vote. Let us no more make excuses for ourselves. You can't fight City Hall, you can't fight the big boys anymore. Because we are not being brave that way. We are making rationalizations of our own futility for no reason, because we're the only ones who have the vote. And if we organize it, focus it, show up, marches, demonstrations, and send a summons to Chris Dodd and the hermaphrodite of American politics, Joe Lieberman, having read their statements justifying their support of this bailout, and Chris Dodd's oratorical statement will go down in history as a collage of deceptions and cover-ups and rationalizations for his surrender to George W. Bush, because he said he put in an oversight board. It's just the same old boy network, vertically, rubber stamp. He said he did something for taxpayer equity. It's so porous that the Secretary of Treasury told his Wall Street buddies, don't worry about it, it's just language, it's unenforceable. He didn't do anything really for homeowner defaults and foreclosures, which should have been the brunt of the bill. This is a bailout of the wrong people. You're gonna bail out people with taxpayer dollars. You bail out the people. You bail out the savers who were prudent. You support the banks who were prudent. You don't support first the crooks and the swindlers on Wall Street. And he rationalized it. You should read it. You should read it as part of your government course in high school or whatever. It's a fascinating panorama. The one thing he hardly dwelled on, in fact, I think I heard his whole speech on C-SPAN radio. He never mentioned that there were $150 billion of freebies for their corporate friends, including a huge tax credit for Microsoft. What are they doing subsidizing one of the richest, most profitable corporations in the United States? I mean, if you're going to subsidize anybody, subsidize beleaguered small business. You subsidize Microsoft? All this was jammed in with no deliberation and with no congressional hearings. How do you think McCain and Obama stood on this bailout? They supported it. I saw this coming. I opposed Clinton's deregulation in 1999 of the financial industry, the banks. I saw it coming when the FDIC was not assessing the banks an accurate amount in good times so that they would have enough in bad times and they would go broke. And I saw it coming. Not the only one that saw it coming, but I certainly saw it coming. And the national press doesn't call me up for comment. Who did they call up for comment? The people who caused it. Robert Rubin, Chairman Greenspan. All these people who were involved in this deregulation to the hilt are the ones that are viewed as advisors and commentators. Obama now has taken on a protege of Robert Rubin as chief economic advisor. And he has other people who are involved in this precipitous mess advising him. McCain likewise. So this is just a way of clarifying. If I can't get you socially indignant to break your routine and to stand up for our country and our descendants and our state in the world and use your best time and energy and skill to build a strong functioning democracy and subordinate corporations to the sovereignty of the people, I do not want your vote. I don't want your vote. I don't want your vote unless you think that voting for Nader Gonzalez is an authentic vote for yourself and your larger framework of what your country should be like, but isn't, because it's being driven into the ground. Latest poll, 9 out of 10 Americans think America is in decline. That's the highest registered conclusion since polling started 110 years ago. 61% think that both parties are failing, major parties. And 3/4 of the people in this country think corporations have too much control over their lives. Globalization, sending whole industry and jobs to fascist and communist regimes because they know how to keep workers in their place at 50 cents an hour. Shame on these U.S. corporations. They have no allegiance to our country anymore. They were born in the USA. They went to profit on the backs of American workers. When they got in trouble through mismanagement or corruption, they went to Washington to be bailed out by American taxpayers. When they got in trouble overseas, the U.S. Marines came to their rescue. Now they come back to the United States, and what's their message to the American worker? We're out of here with your jobs and your industry. Where? To fascist and communist regimes who know how to allow them to pollute at will for bribes, to exploit workers at will for bribes, and to make sure that no one can sue them because there's no judicially independent branch over there, and there is no right to form independent trade unions. You try that in China, you're in jail. That's where we are. A lot of us know this. You may know it in greater detail in one area than your neighbor knows it in the other. We know it. We try not to face it. We try just to get through the day. If you're a single mom and you got 2 kids and you got 2 Walmart-level jobs or a job and a half, you know, you're just trying to get through the day. And a lot of people have become so preoccupied with getting through the day that they haven't stopped to think that if they don't control their government, if they don't subordinate corporations so corporations are our servants, not our masters, as was conceived in Connecticut and Massachusetts in the early 1800s when states chartered these textile companies for the modern corporation era, that they're going to be more preoccupied with their dire personal conditions economically, anxiety, worry about an operation they can't afford because they're not insured. So I think we need a central focus on the corporation versus the people. Now, if you go back through American history, you will see that the cotton plantations opposed the abolition of slavery. You will see that the new industries in the Industrial Revolution opposed women's right to vote. It wasn't just men, some men. They did because the women were really fighting to end child labor in dungeon factories and send the kids to school and have these factories hire their parents. And the women were fighting for consumer protection against the gouging. And the women were fighting against the hard edges of the Industrial Revolution. And these industries sure didn't want women to have the vote. I mean, they were definitely against women's suffrage. And it was the industries who were against the right of workers to form trade unions in the coal mines and the steel mills and the auto and textile factories. And it was the corporations who fought the farmers, the banks and the railroads, and squeezed them until the farmers revolted in the great populist progressive tumult of the late 19th and early 20th century against the banks and the railroads that were squeezing the farmers. Corporations were against Social Security. They were against unemployment compensation. They were against progressive taxes, the progressive tax system. They were against all the regulation, health and safety. They fought us and they fought our predecessors day and night. GM and Chrysler and Ford fought us on auto safety standards. It took us 6 years just to get your rear view mirror to be built in a breakaway fashion. So in a 15-mile-an-hour collision, your head would hit the mirror and your head wouldn't shatter. The rear view mirror would slide away. 6 years they fought us on just something like that. They fought the struggle for a safe workplace. The corporations fought every major progressive legislation in the history of the country for the working people of this country, for the disadvantaged, for the injured, for the disabled. The only thing they didn't fight was the GI Bill of Rights after World War II, because they saw that was a good job training opportunity for their workers. And after a while, you ask yourself, hey, maybe the corporations are the issue. Maybe they're the ones that are standing in the way. And now they're abandoning our country. And it's true. Look at what the American people want now, according to poll after poll. They want full Medicare for all. Who says no? The HMOs, the giant hospital chains, the drug companies. They don't have any vote. The American people have the vote. Who wins? The corporations. Who loses? The American people. 60 years ago, President Truman proposed full Medicare for all. Isn't it about time? The American people think if you work full time, you should earn enough to live on, right? Support your family. McDonald's doesn't believe that. Kmart doesn't believe that. Walmart certainly doesn't believe that. Their executives are making $10,000 to $11,000 an hour, their top executive. And Walmart workers are making $7, $8, $9, $10 an hour, and with very few benefits. Who says no? The corporations. Who wins? The corporations. Who loses? The people with the votes. This is a democracy. And just run through your own areas again and again. In the 1930s, 1940s, the GM and a tire company and oil company conspired to buy up their major competition. Sounds quaint now. It was the trolley systems. They bought them up. The biggest one is Southern California, but in 29 municipal areas, ripped up the tracks and made for highways, just highways, so people have to buy more cars, gasoline, tires. They were convicted by the Justice Department for criminal violation of antitrust laws in Chicago in 1947. But, you know, for the economic crime of the century, which we are still paying for as we go bumper to bumper, back and forth from work, congestion, the judge fined GM $5,000. The deed was done. What was he going to do? He could have done a better job. But it does illustrate how the effects of concentrated power produce serious dislocations and harm and expenses for people who had no role in this mess. They're the innocent victims. Our campaign, which you can look at on votenader.org, it's a great website, by the way. People tell me it's so irreverent, impish, substantive, funny. How many people have seen the website? Yeah. I even have an interchange with an Amazon parrot whose name is Cardozo. He's owned by the former mayor of Salt Lake City, Rocky Anderson, very progressive man. And it was the end of a long day. It was like 1 a.m, and we were sitting, sipping a tea, and there was Cardoza. I figured, might as well have a conversation. Turned out, they said it was good for the internet. You know, who am I to object? I forgot one exchange, which I wished I had remembered, but it was, Cardoza, I know you're in a cage, and you used to be free-flying in the Amazon. You got a good master. But you know what, Cardoza? You're not the only one in a cage. There are millions of voters who the two parties have put in a cage. I wonder how Cardoza would have responded. He was very clever. I said, what's your message to President Bush? He went, goodbye. At any rate. just look, how many times have we seen on 60 Minutes the exposés of waste in the military budget? Staggering waste in various projects where the corporations rip off the taxpayer. And I think most people would want to do something about a bloated, wasteful military budget. I know people in the Pentagon who think there should never have been an F-22, wasn't needed, and it was hazardous, and there shouldn't have been an Osprey helicopter. These are hundreds of billions of dollars you're going to pay for. And who says, yes, they have to be there? Who wants a bigger military budget for their contracts? Well, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, not far from here. Obama and McCain come down on the opposite side again and again. And look at our website, you will see what's on Nader Gonzalez's table and what's off the table for the corporate candidates, Obama and McCain. They haven't even come out for a comprehensive tax system that first taxes things we like the least or dislike the most as a society before we tax human labor. What are we doing taxing human labor first before we tax security derivative speculation, the gambling industries, the addictive industries, the corporate criminals, and the polluters? I mean, aren't those things we want to diminish? So one way to diminish them is to tax them. And to show you what Chris Dodd didn't tell you is that he could, and Barney Frank could, because Washington had Wall Street over a barrel in the last 2 weeks. They could have gotten anything on that bill because Wall Street wanted to be bailed out. But what happened? Wall Street had Washington on the barrel, and the way it ended, Wall Street put Washington in the barrel and rolled it. So here's what they could have said. Okay, you want $700 billion, Wall Street? We're going to make you pay for it. How? Well, we're going to have a 0.1% tax on $500 trillion of derivatives transactions this year, and that's $500 billion. And it's $500 or so billion next year, too. And after they finish paying for their own bailout and dampening some of that speculation, we'll use that money to rebuild the public works, for health insurance, for renovating this, constructing that benefits the people of our country. Now, isn't that something that is absolutely logical to do? You want to be bailed out, you bail out yourself. Now, I'll point out how unfair it is. Here in Connecticut, what's your sales tax, 6 or 7? 6%. You walk into a store here and you buy pretty necessary things. You buy clothing, you buy appliances, you buy furniture, you pay 6%. Now, Monday morning, someone on Wall Street buys $100 million of Exxon derivatives, pays nothing, no sales tax. Is that fair? See what I mean? This is why we have to do our homework. We have to spend more time on our political and civic responsibilities, because once we do, you won't have to have people like me and Dave and others running for office here that you heard exhort you. You will be exhorting us. We will be following you. You will be pushing us with your moral indignation, your sense of unfairness, and the kind of country you want to turn around for your children and your grandchildren. That's what we have to do in politics. So I put out a statement yesterday inviting the taxpayers of America to summon their senators and representatives who are on their way back here for the election, period, and say, we want you to meet in public auditoriums like this, and we want you to explain yourself on that vote, and we want to be ready to ask you questions. And don't think you're going to schmooze us or mislead us. Because we're going to have in this audience people who know that bill backwards and forwards and who know what you did, what you didn't do, what you should do, and what you shouldn't have done. And you're going to be here, and here's the time, right here, Senator Dodd, right here, Senator Lieberman, right here, whatever negative vote, whatever yes vote from your delegation. I think it's only one, Joe Courtney, is the only one who voted against it. All the others, they either voted for on the first round a week ago, or they switched their vote. John Larson voted for it. Chris Murphy voted for it. Harold Burbank's running for Chris Murphy's seat, and he knows what Murphy did inside out on this and other votes. In his young political career, when he's turned into sort of a pet puppy of the Democratic leadership, in the House, Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer. Let's just have this kind of perspective. 220 years ago, we were 13 colonies dominated by King George III. 220 years later, we are 50 colonies dominated by King George IV, and we have taxation without representation. We're right back to where we started. To illustrate what happens when we stop having low expectation levels from our political system, and you've seen it, it's called cynicism. Pox on all, they're all corrupt. And the person who says that sort of feels sophisticated, you know? Doesn't quite know there are two easy ways to go through life, to believe everything or to believe nothing. Both of them avoid thinking. And so the cynics, of which there's an ample supply in every country against their political system, withdraw. The skeptic resurges. That's the difference. Now, when we withdraw, we lower our expectation levels. They're such crooks, can't expect them to do anything for the people. Let's just run our own personal lives and forget these guys. Once your expectation level goes down, your country goes down. It's a perfect correlation. Watch. Eugene Debs, how many people remember Eugene? Eugene Debs, a great labor leader, late 19th and 20th century. And he pulled off the Pullman Railroad strike. It was incredible. Huge rallies. He once took a train to Chicago to address workers in an open field. 200,000 showed up. This was without email. At any rate, he was asked at the end of his career by a reporter, Mr. Debs, what's your greatest regret? He said, my greatest regret? He said, my greatest regret is the American people under our Constitution can have almost anything they want, but it just seems like they don't want much of anything at all. Just think of that. That's low expectation level. Fast forward to end of World War II, the U.S. is the colossus, most powerful economic, military, technological power in the world. At the same time in Western Europe, the cities were in rubble. The countryside destitute. Poverty, starvation, disease reigned. Economies collapsed. Starting in 1945, the people of Western Europe, through their trade unions, their cooperatives, their multi-party system, not two-party, multi-party system, their proportional representation, instant runoff voting, demanded and received by law for all their people universal health care, decent wages, decent pensions, decent public transit. They demanded and received university free tuition. They got paid maternity leave, paid family sick leave. They got 4 weeks paid vacation for all their people. They got decent daycare. 63 years later in the United States, land of the free, home of the brave, huge economy. None of these have been established in law for all our people. And tens of thousands of people are dying every year as a result from just not having health insurance, for example. And thousands of people are getting sick, and hundreds of thousands of people are basically on the verge of destitution. And we have 100 million people who can be called poor in this country. And they work hard, and you do the most dangerous work and the dirtiest work, and they're marginalized, and they're excluded, and they're underpaid, and they're overcharged. The poor get ripped off more. The poor die earlier, and most of them are uninsured. And the only time we seem to like and want them is when we send them to fight our criminal wars overseas. Look at the pictures of the dead soldiers. White, poor whites, Latinos, African Americans. That's who fight our wars. Having said that, isn't that a good yardstick to value the Democrat-Republican Party? These are the basic social benefits of a civilized society. We have a hugely productive society. It's just not distributed. It's not distributed to the people who really produce the sweat on their brow and work every day. And so look, the Republican-Democratic Party, unlike in Europe, they didn't deliver in the 40s. They didn't deliver these in the 50s and 60s and 70s. They didn't deliver in the 80s and the 90s. And in this decade, how many more years, how many more decades are we going to give them so they can prove to us that they're not going to deliver? So they can prove to us that one is slightly less bad than the other. Therefore, you have to vote for the least worst. And for heaven's sake, don't make any demands on your least worst presidential nominee like John Kerry. Don't make any demands. Because you might upset Kerry because he wants to out-hawk Bush on Iraq and send more soldiers there. And he wouldn't have pulled out of Fallujah, he said to Bush on the first debate. And so this merry-go-round every 4 years, least worst. Your spoilers, your third parties, your independent candidates, least go for the least worst. And every 4 years, the least worst candidate can take you for granted because he knows that you're not going to go for the worst. So he doesn't even have to give you anything. He doesn't even have to look back. He goes and becomes more to the right wing and more to the corporate, trying to shave off a few votes from the right side and more money from the corporate side. And every 4 years, it's Mondale, it's Dukakis, it's Clinton, it's Gore, it's Kerry, now it's Obama, and they all moved to the right and the corporate. And they all lost except Clinton, who was saved by Ross Perot. So it isn't exactly a winning strategy for the Democratic Party, is it? The Democratic Party has become very good at electing very bad Republicans. Now, let's look at ourselves as a people, because it's only we, the people, are going to change things. Nobody's going to give it to you. Throughout history, the powers that be have fought the great advances of social justice that the people have pushed forward. That's clear. So it's us. Can't pawn it off on anyone else. Not only that, we outnumber them. Not only that, we have far more votes than they. Not only that, we care more about our children and grandchildren. A corporation is not a human being. It is an entity. It should never be given the constitutional rights of real human beings. It doesn't vote. It doesn't have children. It doesn't die in Iraq. It makes money in Iraq. We're not talking about the employees. We're talking about the corporate entity. By a Supreme Court decision, 1886, a rogue decision gave the railroad the right as a person under our Constitution. And then the courts just elaborated that. So how can you have equal justice under the law, I ask you, between you and General Motors, you and Pfizer, you and the Bank of America, you and ExxonMobil? It's not possible. We have to strip them of their constitutional right to lobby, to engage in politics, and to finance elections. They should be aced out completely of that system. Constitutional rights. Constitutional rights are only for human beings. You want to test that as a poll? Huh? How many people in this country think constitutional rights should be given to non-human beings? I don't mean animals. I mean legal entities created by lawyers. See, investors don't create corporations. They fund them. Corporations are chartered by state government, like Delaware, New York, Connecticut. And that charter can be conditioned. That charter can be conditioned to accommodate the rights and necessities of real human beings. Now, here's the essential, shall we say, misunderstanding of freedom by a lot of people in this country. Cicero, the ancient Roman orator and lawyer, 2,100 or so years ago, defined freedom this way. Freedom is participation in power. Isn't that a great definition? What did he mean? He meant civic freedom. He meant civic freedom to shape your society. He didn't mean personal freedom. And too many people in this country confuse personal freedom with civic freedom. For example, we can eat what we want, buy whatever clothes we want, date who we want, marry who we want, divorce who we want, work where we want, travel where we want, have the hobbies we want, fly whatever kites we want, get into 4,000-pound vehicles and go three blocks to buy Chiclets if we want. Okay? Watch whatever movies we want. Use the clicker to turn on all the TV programs we don't like. That is not civic freedom. I've been to dictatorships, as I'm sure you have, touring or whatever. They have quite a bit of personal freedom as long as they stay out of politics. They can eat what they want, date who they want, marry who they want, travel where they want, have hobbies who they want, go hunting and fishing if they want. We do have more personal freedom than people have in dictatorships because they're poorer. But what about our civic freedom? What is our civic freedom to shape our tax laws, to decide whether we go to war or not? Our civic freedom to recall our representatives and replace them because we would have a competitive democracy with a lot of other party candidates and proportional representation and public funding of public elections. I mean, what is there anything left for us to decide in America other than our personal lives under growing constraints? Is there anything left for us to decide? The great questions, the uses of technology, biotechnology, nanotechnology, those companies are going hell-bent for leather. And they're not telling us what the risks are. They're not telling us what the costs are. They're just boosting their definition of benefits for their profit and loss statement. And once we clarify that because we have personal freedom, doesn't mean we really have the fundamental freedom of citizens in terms of self-governance, in terms of defining our own priorities, in terms of allocating our own public budgets, instead of having the corporation allocate your tax dollars to subsidies, bailouts, handouts, giveaways to the corporation or to the military-industrial complex. Once we decide that there are two separate worlds here, personal freedom, maybe we'll spend more time demonstrating our civic freedom. Maybe our students will learn how to work civic freedom. Maybe our students will have their expectation levels higher than ours in terms of what our political system should be delivering, in terms of what our corporate system should be delivering, in terms of other models of economic development, often called sustainable economies or renewable energy or organic agriculture. Well, let me just end on this note, and then we'll have a good discussion. But two points. I want to thank Harold Burbank, Gail Weed, James Eaton, and Pete Elner for their volunteer effort in this whole state, making this four stops today in my native state possible and successful, and all the other volunteers. And right here, especially UConn for Nader. That's good. That's good. Thank you. I hope they have another title, UConn for themselves, too. I'm going to invite up here, one of the reasons we're doing this campaign is to bring the young generation into having an appetite for clean politics and political skills and organizing skills and running for, in a few years, for local and state office. And an example of that younger generation is Matt Zawiski, who's from Buffalo, from a blue-collar family, and he has been with us for 7 years as an organizer. So balancing a lot of things on the road in very fast and complex situations. And he has some things to say to bring you up to date and to show you, invite you, how you can help us even more than you've helped us now. But I want to, before I have him on, I want to give you one short story, and that is in thanking people around the country who support us. We received one day a $1,300 contribution from a 64-year-old Vietnam vet who was suffering from Agent Orange disease, you know, the chemical warfare over in Vietnam that actually got our own soldiers, boomeranged on our own soldiers. And I said, thank you very much for contributing to us. And he said, I didn't contribute it to you. I contributed to the kind of country I want us to be. And I went like this, like, wow, this reminds me of something. It reminds me of my father, who would say, you're not giving to charity, you're giving to your own community, betterment. And it's that's the kind of, shall we say, irreverent attitude that really extends the trusteeship to us and really makes us not just humble in that sense, but it makes us very sensitive to where our money comes from and how frugally we use it. And we take no money from commercial interests, and we take no money from political action committees. So I will be back after Matt gets through making his presentation, and it's Matt Zawiski. Now we can have a good discussion. Thank you.